I'm Jerry Hinkle. Couple of administrative notes. Number one, Noah's been nice enough to produce a really nice, you know, one-page front and back, summary of his presentation and summary of the analysis that Columbia has done of our bill, of H.R. 763. So do me a favor, don't look at it now. Have your attention up here, but it's a great takeaway, or leave behind, if you will. We'll be taking questions. Noah's going to talk for about 40 minutes, and then we're going to do questions. And so what I'd like you to do, a couple of fabulous interns, Skylar and someone else, if you could wave your hand. So they will pass out cards if you need them or collect questions from you, okay? And I'll look through those and I'll actually present the questions to Noah. It'll be a little bit more efficient that way. We'll do that at the end. So let me introduce Dr. Kaufman. This will help. So Dr. Kaufman joined the Columbia Center on Global Energy Policy as research scholar in January 2018. So he's actually the director of the Carbon Tax Research Initiative. And they've done some just outstanding work. So when Carlos Curbelo's bill came out in July 2018, Columbia had the analysis ready to make it a much more informed, you know, on the energy and economic impacts of that bill. That was an important bit of work. And then in November, when our bill came out, he did a comparative study of three other bills and ours. That was somewhat preliminary. This is a much deeper dive. So he's done very important work for us. Prior to that, he'd worked at World Resources Institute, led projects on carbon pricing, the economic impacts of climate policies, and long-term decarbonization strategies. He worked in the Obama administration as the Deputy Associate Director of Energy and Climate Change at the White House Council of Environmental Quality. He's got a PhD in economics from University of Texas. Right? Anybody here from, there you go, hook 'em horns. And he's been a great friend to us. Great news for this organization is people like Noah and I, we are walking this path together. And that's, it's a real contribution to us. So please welcome Dr. Noah Kaufman.
Thank you, Jerry. This is so cool that you guys are all here and this event that you're all put on. I'm very excited to be here. That was a very generous introduction. I should say it's probably obvious, but I did not do this work anywhere near by myself. Actually, my colleague Peter Marsters is right there who has helped with the work. And it's also, we have partners at the Rhodium Group. And I'll talk more about them in a minute, but this is sort of a collaborative effort. This work I'm going to show you. I should have tried to make sure this worked to begin with. It does. Terrific. Okay. So Jerry sort of introduced us already, but we're the Center on Global Energy Policy. So we are part of Columbia University. Even though we're academics, though, our goal at the center is to produce policy-relevant research, articles, convenings, events. Really policymakers, and frankly, you guys are our audience. So it's terrific to be able to do work like this. The Carbon Tax Research Initiative is just one component of that. As Jerry said, we've been doing all different types of work on carbon tax design and implications over the last couple of years. Just want to be sort of totally straight with you guys about where I'm coming from, because that's important for you to know. I am among the roughly 100% of economists who think a carbon pricing policy is a good idea. It's frankly insane that we have a federal carbon price of zero in our country. So from that perspective, I'm an advocate, right? Because we need a carbon price. I'll also say that I've long been an admirer of CCL. The people that you guys have, what you've accomplished, also how you've accomplished it. Very impressed by your organization. Now that I've buttered you up, I also want to just be clear that I'm not here as an advocate for any particular carbon pricing policy. Where I think our value is, and hopefully our value to you guys too, is to talk about the different trade-offs of very real imperfections with any policy proposal that you'll see, sort of tell you, based on our independent analysis, what's great about your bill and what some of the weaknesses are also, because you should know that too. So that's what I'm going to do today. I guess first I'll just mention too, I mentioned the Rhodium Group up front. They're kind of the best in the business, in my opinion, at doing energy emissions modeling. They take the U.S. government's, the NEMS model, it's called. It's sort of the energy model that the Energy Information Administration uses. In my opinion, they kind of make it a lot better so it can analyze policies like a carbon tax and other climate and energy policies. As Jerry mentioned, we've done this type of analysis of impacts of carbon pricing policies for a bunch of other policies in the past. This, of course, this one will be about the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, focusing on the version that was released in the House early in 2019. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through the bill itself and the assumptions, on the assumption that you guys are familiar with it. Is that fair? Okay, great. So I'll just say we assume everything gets implemented starting next year. I'll also say our analysis, while the preliminary analysis is complete, don't get too angry if you see our final report out in a month or two. Maybe some numbers here and there will change as we go through our expert review process. Our methodology has been reviewed, so I'm not too worried about any major changes, but need to say that as a caution. So the rest of the presentation, what I'm going to do is focus on showing you our results. What does this bill do for emissions? What does it do to the U.S. energy system in terms of production and prices? And then focus on the carbon dividend and the government revenue side of things. Those three are really, like, in my mind, sort of the big three impacts of a carbon price. We'll get through those for sure. If I have time at the end, we'll talk a little bit about how this bill compares to other proposals, and then a little bit on impacts beyond the scope of our specific analysis. So our analysis focuses on emissions and energy market impacts, but there's still quite a bit we can say about what we know about the economic impacts of policies like this as well. So a couple cautions down there too. This is a modeling exercise. So we like to think these are, very educated guesses, but these are models. They're imperfect, right? So please take all modeling results you see with a grain of salt. I'll talk a little bit more about limitations of projections as we go forward. But ours is like any model, in that it's imperfect. So why don't we start with emissions? This chart, what it shows you is U.S. economy-wide net greenhouse gas emissions, right? So this is sort of the big picture, everything, all sources and sinks of greenhouse gases in the country that contribute to climate change. So on the left side axis there, you have total emissions. There are percentages on the right that compares you to 2005 levels. So what you see in blue is what our modeling shows for where the country is headed under policies in place in 2018. There's a range there, just because we always do our work in ranges to reflect things like technological uncertainty. You know, we don't know exactly how much solar or wind batteries are going to cost over 10 years, so we take a range of assumptions in all of our different scenarios. But as you can see, under current policies, emissions in the country are roughly flat over the next 10 years. Once you put the policy in place, with the carbon fee in place, you see emissions dramatically turning down, down to about 40 or so percent below 2005 levels by 2030. So in a way, this is the bottom line, right? I could have just come up here, shown you this, said, without the policy, we fail. With the policy, we succeed. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk, and just left you on your way. But we have some more time, so I'll give you a little more information than that. But keep this in mind. I think this is really important. What happens when we break this out a little bit, though? Here, what this chart shows you is emissions broken out by power sector emissions. So this is the electricity system. That's what you see on the bottom. And then on the top, that's everything else. Emissions from transportation, fossil fuel use in buildings, industry. And what you see is, first of all, power sector is roughly a quarter of total emissions. We talk about it a lot, but it's not the whole picture by a long shot. And secondly, this is where most of the action is in terms of emissions reductions in the 2020s. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. You have electric utilities who are able to relatively quickly get rid of coal-fired power plants and put in solar, wind, more natural gas. And that's what you're seeing happening to a large extent in terms of power sector emissions. In terms of everything else, the carbon taxes or the price on carbon is beginning to work, but it's slow. And that sort of is intuitive, too, if you think about the fleet of vehicles, right, or the natural gas furnace in your home. It takes a while for that to turn over. You don't make decisions every day. When you make a decision about switching out your furnace, it's not necessarily on price alone. And the price just is a smaller component of the total cost than something like, paying for electricity. So that's why you see sort of a different story when you break it out by sector. Instead of just, economy-wide, this is a pathway to net zero by 2050. But when you break it out by sector, you see the power sector is on a pathway to zero emissions much before that, in the 2030s. Whereas everything else, you need a lot more work there to get on a trajectory, down towards zero. And I'll say one other thing about this, too. What we've found in our previous modeling of other carbon pricing bills is that to get those emissions reductions in the power sector, you don't actually need a carbon price that's quite as high as the one in this bill. We looked at proposals that started at, it's a different trajectory, that starts at maybe $50 a ton, goes up to $70 or $80 a ton. You get similar reductions in the power sector in the 2020s from that kind of bill as you do from this bill that starts at $15 and goes up over $100 a ton by 2030. Okay, so before I go on to the next slide, I wanted to say just a few words about why you should be somewhat skeptical of any sort of modeling results that you see like this. And I hope a lot of these are sort of intuitive when you think about it, too. Number one, we can't predict the future. That's pretty intuitive, right? We know over the next few decades there'll be changes in energy technologies, markets, preferences that we can't predict today. And models like this, or any model you see, they don't try to do that. They're rough, they're sort of static. They assume the structure of the energy system will stay the same. In fact, when you put a price on carbon, one of the main reasons for doing that is to channel that productivity or that innovation in a low carbon direction. So we're not going to be picking up on that sort of induced innovation in a model like this either. We assume, sort of a separate topic here, we assume that consumers will react to a carbon tax the same way that they react to any other price changes. It's actually easy to imagine that that wouldn't be the case, that you'd have a policy and it would be seen, the price change would be seen as sort of, you'd notice it, it'd be perceived as more permanent than maybe your day-to-day fluctuations in gas prices. We don't factor that in. There's also the point that U.S. policy is going to influence action around the world. That's, this is a global problem. That's why we put in place climate policy. Our modeling sort of looks at U.S. action in isolation, and even though we do include international trade, we don't account for the effect the U.S. policy could have on greater action overseas, and therefore sort of the implications that could have for fossil fuel markets, for example. So might be getting into the weeds, but all of these things I bring up to say, number one, there's a lot of uncertainty in these results. And number two, a lot of them tend to point into the direction of a carbon price being more effective at reducing emissions and the energy system being more flexible than models like this one tend to portray. So I wanted to bring that up before showing the next slide, which does take a slightly longer term view. And essentially what this slide does is shows you in green, again, that's our modeling results for total emissions. Now out to 2035, or this is emissions that are actually taxed under the policy. And then what you have in black here is the emissions reductions targets that are stipulated in the bill itself. So this is sort of the pathway to 90% by 2050, which is the metric I'm sure you're all familiar with. And what we find is that the taxed emissions stay below the emissions targets throughout the 2020s, but by the 2030s, because of the reasons I mentioned earlier, outside the power sector, you see taxed emissions rising above the emission reduction targets. So, could be because our model is underestimating, the sort of flexibility of the energy system. Or it could be that there's these real factors in sectors outside the power sector that means really any price on carbon is just going to have a limited effect. There are sort of non-price barriers in the way to progress. So as you probably know, what happens in the bill, if taxed emissions fall above or rise above this path, that means at some point in the 2030s, the tax rate starts to go up faster. It also means that I think it's EPA or government regulations come in to sort of fill in the gap and mandate that you get to 90% by 2050. We didn't model that. This is just sort of an implication of our output. I will say, if you believe that scenario to be true, it arguably makes a lot more sense to put those other policies in place earlier on, right? So if you're in talking about policies in these other sectors up here, transportation, turning over the vehicle fleet to a clean vehicle fleet, buildings, making sure we have electric heat pumps heating our houses instead of furnaces. These are sort of long-term, sort of big innovation challenges, infrastructure challenges that are going to take a long time. So that's an argument for saying, let's not wait until the 2030s to put in place some of these other policies that we might need to get to sort of a deep decarbonization outcome in 2050. So that's all I'm going to say about emissions for now. Moving on to energy market impacts. So I work at an energy policy center. So we have a lot of great detail underlying these results, and I'm happy to answer questions about it. But I just wanted to point out a couple different sort of high-level findings here. Number one, the impacts on coal. So a lot of you probably know this, but if you look at 2030 production of coal, what you see is, so the blue bars here is where we're headed today under current policies. There's this, I think a lot of people have this sort of coal is going away feeling, coal is dying in our country. It's really not totally dying. We're still producing a lot of coal today. It's about a quarter of our electricity generation. Our modeling suggests it's going to go down a little bit, but really only gradually over the next decade. If you were to put a carbon price like this one in place, it falls pretty close to zero basically zero in the power sector, and really falls off a cliff in terms of overall coal production. So there's two sides to this to think about. Number one, coal is by far the most harmful of the fossil fuels, right? It's the most carbon intensive. It has the most harmful other impacts in terms of air pollution as well. So that's an enormous win for this bill to reduce those down near zero. On the other hand, important to keep in mind that coal, the production of coal in the country is also very geographically concentrated. Not a lot of places do it. It's not a huge industry. But where they do, in Appalachia, in Wyoming, Montana, you see towns and counties that really rely on coal production. So not just workers, but you have, you know, governments and schools funded on coal industry revenue. So we haven't gone any deeper than that in terms of this analysis, but it's just an important implication of the policy to keep in mind. Wrong way. Electricity generation. So we talk a lot about where our electricity comes from. As I showed earlier, that's where most of sort of the change happens in the 2020s because of the bill. What these pictures show you is 2020 and 2030, both under current policy and under the carbon fee, where is our electricity coming from? So the takeaway here is to look out at this slide all the way on the right here. So in 2030, under the bill, what you see is coal basically gone out of the electricity system. And you see it being replaced by renewables. That's a lot more wind. It's a lot more solar. And we even, in our modeling, see quite a bit of carbon capture and storage with natural gas coming in as well. And you have less natural gas without carbon capture and storage, which combined makes for a grid that's not 100% clean, but something along the lines of 75% clean by 2030. Keep going the wrong way. All right, so finally, energy prices. So you all know that a carbon price is going to increase the price of energy, right? That's the whole point. You make it more expensive, people use less of it. These are sort of, that'll happen across the whole energy system. Here are two metrics that you're probably more familiar with, gasoline and electricity prices. Because of the trajectory of the tax rate, the effects are really small in the 2020s, hardly noticeable. But once you get to 2030, they get to be pretty sizable. So in terms of dollars per gallon, something on the order of magnitude of $1 per gallon change in gasoline prices caused by the carbon fee. So this is where you probably know, if you're going to see the opposition to a bill like this, this is where the focus is. Energy prices go up, and that will have real effect on consumers. But you know, I think the key is never to look at the energy price increases in isolation, right? They should always be looked at alongside the revenue, which is what we'll go to next, because the energy price increases, they don't disappear, but they become revenues to the government, and under your policy at least, they go right back to consumers. So the question shouldn't be how much does your energy prices go out, or like how much are you willing to pay because your energy prices go up? You should be looking at that net effect between how much you're paying extra and how much you're getting back in the carbon dividends. So first of all, in terms of total revenue, this is a lot of money. This is on the order of $300 to $400 billion per year in revenue that comes in because of the carbon tax payments by the end of the 2020s. That's a big new source of government revenue. In your bill, the vast majority of this revenue, after some administrative expenses, goes to dividend payments. So we did some calculations to try to figure out roughly how much those dividend payments would be over the 2020s. We found eligible adults would get, by the end of the 2020s, somewhere in the $1,200 to $1,400 per year range. Children would get about half that amount. So by 2030, that's something like $100 plus per month for eligible adults. I think the natural question when you see this is, how does this compare to the energy price changes? How much of what you're paying, how does that compare to what you're getting back? And it's a great question, and it's a really difficult question to answer, as it turns out, for a lot of reasons. But one thing we did was just to take a look at total energy expenditures in the country without the policy and with the policy, and divide that by the total population. So this is what this chart's showing, that calculation, energy expenditures per capita. So the blue line shows it's roughly flat over the 2020s without the policy, and it's steadily increasing up with the carbon tax, with the policy in place. Although, sort of an interesting side note is that even with the 100 plus dollar per ton price on carbon in the 2030s, you still don't quite get as high as these levels were back in 2008 when we had sort of the commodity boom. But in any case, the natural comparison, I think, is to say how much on average are people paying more because of the carbon price versus how much are they getting in the dividends. And it's not a very good comparison because some of these energy expenditures are going to be incurred by businesses, for example. They wouldn't necessarily be incurred by households. You have lots of tax implications with both the dividend and the expenditures. And the regional variation in a lot of these things is huge. So I really shouldn't do this, but I know you want to see it, so I put them on the same graph anyway. I wanted to give the people what they wanted here. And what we see is in 2020, the increased per capita expenditures are a bit larger than the annual dividend for the adult, and that flips in 2030, where you have the annual dividend a little larger than the per capita expenditures. So I would, again, I would take the exact numbers with a grain of salt. I'm not sure they mean much, but to sort of say on a rough order of magnitude, the dividends are offsetting the energy price effects is fair. So the last thing I wanted to talk about in the revenue, from the revenue perspective, is what happens to sort of the net US federal government revenue. And the first thing I'll say about this is I'm not sure we should care so much. We don't really have a correct answer for what the right size of government should be, what the deficit should be. It's not obvious to me that we even know what we want the answer to this question to be, but it's a question that a lot of people ask, right? When you see carbon pricing bills, a lot of times you see revenue neutrality, revenue positive, revenue negative attached to it. So even though I don't think it's the most important aspect, I think it's important that people understand, given the rhetoric around it, what the answer might be. This chart is meant to sort of help you conceptualize the different effects on government revenue, split it out into first, second, and third order effects. So first order effects, very easy. Carbon tax brings in a lot of revenue. It's all paid out in dividends, sort of even Steven, 100%. The second order effects, a bit more complicated. So two main things to think about here. First of all, if you think of a business that pays the carbon tax, that business will have less money or less revenue in its pocket to pay income taxes, to pay payroll taxes. That's why there's sort of this very standard income and payroll tax offset whenever a tax like this is implemented. And what analyses like ours have found is that means about 20 to 25% of the total carbon tax revenue is going to be lost by the government due to this offset. So that brings down government revenue by a fair amount. On the other side of the coin, you have the dividends going into people's pockets as income. Those dividends are going to be taxed. Because the US income tax system is pretty progressive, what we find is that will bring in an additional amount of revenue that's not 20 to 25%, but something on the order of 11 or 12%. So that's what this arrow is here. And then we have these third order effects, which basically is to say the economy is going to change in a lot of ways when you transition from high carbon to low carbon energy sources. That's going to have a lot of effects in terms of different economic activity is going to shift from some sectors to another. Those sectors are going to be taxed differently. These various effects, when you pay out dividends to people, people are going to spend that money in very different ways. Hard to know all the different implications of that, which is why we have question marks here. Kind of the bottom line is that the effects on government revenue overall are pretty uncertain. So probably just spent too much time on that to say we don't know the answer, but we don't know what the policy will do to government revenues. Based on our best guesses in the early years, we might guess that revenue declines by something on the order of 10 to 12% of the carbon tax revenue. And then lastly, not sure we should care. Okay, so how much time do I have left? Do you know? About 10 minutes?
Minutes.
Okay, so we have some time. I'm going to spend a few minutes just talking about stuff beyond the scope of our specific analysis, just because there's a long literature on carbon pricing policies and sort of carbon price and dividend policies that should apply to this policy also. So I think it's worth noting. First of all, in terms of impacts across the income distribution, what we found and what really any economic study that looks at carbon price and dividend policies have found is that they're really progressive. So what that means is that low and middle income households will receive a lot more in dividends than they pay in extra additional energy expenditures because of the carbon price. And the reason for that is that rich people buy more of everything, right? So poor people don't spend as much money on energy, commodities, anything else. So they pay less of the carbon fee, but they receive the same amount in dividends. So they, on average, come out way ahead. Second thing, in terms of macroeconomic impacts, so this is trying to take a look at what are the effects on GDP, gross domestic products, total investment and consumption across the economy. And if you think energy modeling is uncertain, economic modeling is sort of an added level of crystal balls that you have to whip out to figure out where the economy is going and how specific policies will change them. But we've tried, and other places have tried to. And what we tend to find when we do these sorts of studies is that, first of all, you sort of start with the one on top, which is if we're looking for a way to reduce emissions, price on carbon has to be involved if you're talking about sort of a cost-effective strategy. Not sufficient in itself, but it's sort of a necessary component of a cost-effective strategy. And then number two, if you're looking at sort of just a, sort of like we were doing before, a carbon pricing case versus a no policy at all case or a current policy case, when you use the revenue for dividends, you show small negative impacts on gross domestic product. And the reason for that is because essentially you're putting a constraint on the economy, you're sort of not letting people use high carbon products, and you're paying them money back, you're giving the money back in terms of dividend, but you're not using it, the money, in a way that changes the structure of the economy in sort of a pro-growth way. So what studies like ours have found is that if you were to use the money in ways like cutting payroll taxes, for an example, that would not only return the money to Americans, it would also sort of change the incentives of the economy so that people are more encouraged to invest and to hire and to work more. So you tend to get better economic outcomes for those revenue uses. And as I mentioned up front, economic impact studies have a lot of problems, and I think the main one I want to mention is that they tend to focus on the short term, right? So when we're thinking about a carbon price, really we should be thinking about the long-term impacts on what happens if we can decarbonize the economy and potentially even the world with it, and what are the economic impacts we can avoid by putting in place a policy like this. So then the last thing I'll mention on these other impacts are regional impacts. And it's actually really hard to do studies of this. We're hopefully going to do sort of more granular state-level analysis over the next couple of years. But in general, what we know are, number one, coal communities, which I mentioned earlier, get hit the hardest for obvious reasons. That's the industry that suffers the most. And then number two, just rural areas in general tend to have fewer clean alternatives to switch to. So those are the two places to sort of to watch out for in terms of adverse impacts. On the flip side, you have certain parts of the country that do really well. You know, the urban places that are sort of more urbanized, the coasts tend to do better when you do regional economic impact modeling. So in the couple minutes I have left, I'm going to compare Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act to some of the other carbon pricing proposals that are out there, or that have been sort of proposed in Congress or getting a lot of attention. And actually, this slide isn't quite right. The purple line is the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, but I noticed on the way here that it should be even a little bit higher in 2030. But the general message is still true compared to these other policies. So the red line here is Congressman Curbelo's policy from last year, which showed, these are carbon tax rates from these policies. So dollars per ton on the left, years across the bottom. So you have Curbelo bill with relatively low carbon tax rates. You have a group of Democratic senators led by Sheldon Whitehouse with carbon tax rates that start quite a bit higher than your proposal, but then by 2030 are lower. And then you have this, it's labeled as Baker, this is sort of the Climate Leadership Council Baker-Schultz plan that is somewhere in the middle. So your proposal has the highest carbon tax rates by 2030. In terms of other sort of important design elements to keep in mind, first of all, it's the second one listed here, but related to the tax rates, what I think makes your proposal unique is this sort of 90% by 2050 mandate, which you get to, number one, by raising the tax rates if emissions targets are missed, and then number two, having sort of the EPA come in and put regulations in if, again, the emissions targets are missed. Other bills don't have that kind of stringency. You do have differences in revenue uses. Carbon dividends in your proposal and the Baker proposal. Curbelo's bill uses most of the money for infrastructure. Senator Whitehouse's bill cuts issues credits to payroll taxes with most of its revenue. And then finally, important to look at what other policy changes go alongside the carbon price. So you're probably aware, so in your bill, there's sort of the suspension of EPA regulations of CO2 emissions that are also covered by the carbon price, which is a pretty common thing to do in proposals like this one. But Senator Whitehouse's bill doesn't include anything like that. The Baker bill has really emphasized these sort of other policy changes, but we don't know the details of it yet. But I wanted to end on this just because I wanted to give a pitch for a study that we put out earlier this year that takes a look at how carbon prices interact with other climate policies in terms of which other policies fit really well or complementary with the carbon price, which ones are more redundant in terms of not achieving more emissions reductions but costing more. And what we found was this was the bottom line of the study. We created a criteria that allowed us to look at this. This is sort of the bottom line chart here that shows quite a few policies are actually fit in really nicely with the carbon price. Regulations of emissions that aren't covered, innovation, infrastructure, efficiency standards, these are all sort of, as I mentioned earlier, you have a lot of barriers to low carbon energy sources that have nothing to do with the price. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the most redundant policies. So in that category, we had one sort of topic or one category of policies, and that is regulations of emissions that are also covered by the carbon price. So I think this is important for you guys just because the suspension of the EPA regulations in your bill falls very clearly in the most redundant of the regulations category. So please go on our website, print out this handy chart, and use it as you talk to policymakers about this aspect of your bill. So I ended buttering you up also. Hopefully that puts you in the good mood for any questions that that you might have. But thank you again for your time.
Peter says use the mic, and I'm in the habit of obeying him. So the first question is, clearly we've seen the 3,500 economists support really the principles of our bill. What are they up to? Why do they insist that this is the right thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So I think you start with the premise, you don't want your economists to be studying climate science, right? You want your climate scientists to do that. But once you've established that climate change is a problem and that we have the ability to solve it by reducing our emissions, that's where you bring economists in to say, how can we do this in the most cost-effective or economically beneficial way? And what economists have long realized is that the carbon price is the only way to ensure that you're encouraging emissions reductions wherever and however they can be achieved at the lowest cost, right? If you use any other sort of policy structure, if you say emissions have to happen in this place or using this technology or in this sector, you're going to get some low-cost emissions reductions and some high-cost emissions reductions, but you're not going to have the carbon price sort of ensuring that you're achieving those emissions reductions at the lowest possible cost.
Very nice, thanks. People have a lot of questions. I may have to limit you to three-word answers, so
sorry.
This will be, we'll see just how good you are. And actually what we'll do, NOAA had come out and done a Citizens Climate University 9-10 months ago or so, and after your report comes out, maybe we'll have you back again, but I'll try to rapid fire get
Great.
You a few. What are the economic impacts to state and local governments?
Yeah, it's a good, important question, and my short answer is that we don't have the answer to that.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, good. I got a few more of those. Will you estimate the impact on income quintile, or by income quintile and region, in your report?
So we don't do that in this specific report. We do have previous work that has looked at those questions, or at least the questions about impacts across the income distribution for various hypothetical policies, including sort of a fee and dividend structure. So as I mentioned before, anytime you use the revenue for equal dividends, what you're gonna find is low-income households do really well. Middle-income households do pretty well. And rich households do not as well. And you'd expect that to happen with your proposal also. Regional impacts we haven't done yet. And I don't think anyone has done a really good job of that. So that's why we're sort of making that an emphasis of ours in the next couple of years.
Okay, great. How do your results differ from the REMI study, which I know you're familiar with?
It's been a while, to be honest, since I've looked at the REMI study. So my understanding of the REMI study was that it was more of a economic impact analysis. So I don't remember the details of it off the top of my head, but a model like REMI is going to look at more macroeconomic outcomes, where we have a very granular energy sector model that's going to be sort of better suited to look at the emissions and energy market impacts that I spent most of the time on here.
Okay. How can we reduce greenhouse gas emissions from land use?
So I have a reference for you, which is everyone should take a look at the U.S. mid-century strategy for deep decarbonization, which is a study I got to work on the energy sector component of when I was working at the White House a few years ago. Best work I've ever seen on this topic in terms of how do we get to a low-carbon economy, both on the energy side and then, in this case, in terms of land sector strategies, but I am not an expert on the topic, so I'm not going to speak to it.
Okay.
The U.S. mid-century strategy for deep decarbonization.
Very good. What are the shortcomings of cap and trade in the minds of economists?
That is a leading question. In terms of sort of carbon tax versus cap and trade, these are both carbon prices. So everything I talked about at the beginning in terms of the need to put a price on carbon, these are both ways to do it. I think they're far more similar policies than they are different. They just, cap and trade, you have more markets you have to set up. You have less uncertainty on the emissions side. You have more uncertainty in terms of what the price levels will be. I think the important thing about a carbon price or a carbon tax is that it gives you some upside in terms of all the things I mentioned about why we might think a carbon tax is more effective at reducing emissions than sort of our models suggest, means that we get to capture those additional emissions reductions after we put the policy in place. With a cap and trade policy, it's great if you set your emissions caps well to begin with at sort of the target you want. But a lot of times in the real world, we've seen emissions caps that have been set not all that stringent, all that stringently, and then you have a hard time reducing emissions below that because you've set your emissions cap and the policy doesn't let you take advantage of that sort of additional innovation effect that you would have on emissions.
Great. Are you able to consider in the model that you just showed the impacts of extreme weather and the increased costs on government, as well as the costs of additional health care required because of the emissions?
No.
All right. You know, that was kind of a setup. So, have there been studies on the effects of the border carbon adjustment on international trade, on consumer welfare?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something that I forgot to mention at all in my presentation. So we do have sort of a proxy for the border carbon adjustment in our model, but it's a relatively crude proxy. Essentially, what the border carbon adjustment does is take the most energy intensive products and protects U.S. competitiveness in terms of the production of these products. And they do that by putting basically a carbon fee on imports of the products and provides the same rebate to exports of the products, which is intended to hold U.S. producers harmless in the face of a policy like this, and also prevent them from jumping overseas, avoiding the regulation, and missing out on sort of the global emissions reductions. So I say that just to say we did model it, just to make sure you didn't have this sort of leakage of emissions or competitiveness impacts in the model. But we haven't specifically, I think the answer to that specific question is no, because we're assuming the border carbon adjustment works very well in the model that we have in place here. It's complicated in reality, trying to figure out how specifically to put in place these assumptions that will sort of appropriately account for the policies that other countries have put in place to make sure you don't start a trade war bigger than the one we already have by taxing other countries' products. So I do think it's an area that needs quite a bit more study.
Great. I think you've answered this, but I'm getting a couple questions along these lines, so you may have to sort of underline something. Would low-income households tend to have a higher marginal propensity to consume, spend more of the money? If they're getting more money and they're spending more of that, wouldn't that be net stimulative, and therefore shouldn't GDP grow as a result of the policy?
Well, I mean, I agree with the first part of that. I don't have any numbers off the top of my head, but it's certainly intuitively true that you give low-income households, they're going to be more likely to spend, less likely to save. They're getting the same dividend check in this policy, so it's not immediately obvious to me that at least in a sort of full employment economy that we may or may not live in right now, that's not in a recession, that would be stimulative to GDP. But it's also quite possible that it would be. And I don't want to sort of speak too strongly on either side of that. What we show in our models is that, as I mentioned before, the sort of dividend does less than doing things like reducing people's taxes in terms of boosting GDP. But it's very possible we are missing some of these details, like the propensity to spend from low-income households.
Okay. How would you respond to health organizations who are concerned about the regulatory pause in the bill and the effect it may have on health?
I mean, I think the answer should be, the way the bill is written, that it shouldn't have any effect on health regulations, because the way I understand the bill is that you're only putting a pause on CO2 emissions regulations, and carbon dioxide doesn't have any sort of local health impacts, number one. And number two, the carbon price is probably going to incentivize quite a bit more change than the types of regulations that we've seen, the Clean Power Plan, for example, in the power sector. The effect of the carbon price would just swamp that. So for those reasons, I don't think that this is a concern, unless you're not regulating. I guess two things would have to be the case. Number one, you would have to be not regulating these other pollutants properly. Like, we have regulations in place under the Clean Air Act that are supposed to take care of these local air pollutants. It is easy to argue that they're not stringent enough. So you have the carbon price reducing other emissions, and you absolutely get these benefits from them. But like I said, you'd also have to assume that these other regulations were going to do more than the carbon price to sort of incentivize change from consumers and businesses, which carbon prices at this level, I just wouldn't be worried about.
Very good. What sector of the GDP does your model indicate takes the most significant hit under carbon fee and dividend?
This isn't an economic impact model that we ran, so we don't have GDP results for you. But in the previous studies that we've looked at, the economic impacts, if you look on a sector to sector basis, are very focused on the sort of energy sector and economic activity that comes out of the energy sector, and then even more granular than that, coal. Right, coal is where the big impacts are in the early years. So, when you talk about energy prices, the carbon price being factored into the price of energy being passed along to the price of consumer goods, it's all really small. Not the case with coal and the effects on coal communities. So, that's just what I want to emphasize in terms of the regional or sectoral impact.
Okay, and there's a corollary question: Industry impacts be significantly different under a tax swap, say a payroll tax swap?
I wouldn't expect them to be under a payroll tax. I mean, unless you're swapping taxes for a specific industry, no, I wouldn't expect them to be a lot different.
Okay. Have you modeled the capital stock impacts and the ability of the economy to generate capital investment required to make the energy consumption transition?
So I guess the question is just, if I'm understanding it correctly, is looking at sort of the normal stock turnover in equipment and vehicles and all that, and is that contained within the model? Is that a fair?
Yeah. please.
Yes, please.
Do we have enough money to pay for it?
There you go.
Yeah, well, I mean, so The beauty of the price on carbon is that you don't need an huge exogenous source of funds to make it happen. You're just putting in place the price signal, and that's what's causing most of the change. So I mentioned net government revenue could adjust downward or upward a bit, and you probably do need a lot of money, for some of these complementary policies to fund innovation and to, build out a clean transportation infrastructure. But you're raising the money with the carbon price. You could use that in... Sure.
And did everybody hear and understand the question?
No.
Just to make sure.
So I think that's...
Does your model help us understand that?
Right. So the issue is, even though the incentives are in place to do so, or the prices might suggest that you should, is there enough capital available in the economy or to just fund the specific projects you need to achieve the emissions reductions that we're showing here? And the answer is that in a model like this, or in most economic models, you're going to have sort of prices change to create the amount of capital that you would need. I mean, you could imagine that there could be liquidity constraints somewhere that wouldn't be captured by any model. But in general, it's not something I worry too much about, because we, in a well-functioning economy, absent a lot of sort of the parts of markets don't work perfectly, and I don't want this to come off like I think they do, but I do think we have mechanisms in place that will draw investment to sort of low-cost opportunities to produce electricity, and to if you're an industry, you're going to be looking for those low-cost opportunities to run your business and to minimize costs while you do it.
Comment on the rate of increase in the under this particular bill.
The rate of carbon tax increase,
the $10 a year.
Yeah, well, it's unique in a way, at least in terms of a lot of proposals are out there. I don't think there's a right answer for how fast or slow you should ramp up your tax rates. I think you guys would know this better than I would, but my sense of the reason for a rate increase like this is mostly sort of to make it gradual, so it's not a shock to the economy on day one that you would have big price changes. So to some extent, if I were arguing for something like a $50 per ton tax to start with, I would say that you pass a bill, you have some time before people realize it's coming in, so it's not really like you find out about it and the next day prices go up. There's going to be some gradualness to it, but I definitely think this goes a step further and says we want to we're not looking to create an abrupt shift in the economy. We're looking to gradually but rapidly evolve to a low carbon economy, and I think that's the reason behind the tax rate acceleration. But I guess if the question was from like a first principle standpoint, do I have an opinion on it? Not really.
Okay, just a couple more questions, mm-hmm. and we're going to let you stop and sit down and get a drink of water.
And
thank you so much in advance. Obviously, we could not get enough of you, and we will hope to have you back in some way, shape, or form. I'm getting a number of questions on, you did analysis to 2030 and a bit beyond. What can you tell us about 2030? And you may have a thought as to the reliability of that information and why you don't focus on it in this analysis.
You mean beyond 2030?
That's beyond 2030, 2035, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you should run models like this for as far as you're willing to project out technological change and changes in preferences and things like that. So to my eyes, 2030 is even stretching it, 10 to 12 years. I mean, if you think back 10 to 12 years ago, where are we, like 2006 or 2007? A lot of things we wouldn't have been able to predict back then. And I'm guessing any 10 or 12 year period, you'd see the same. So that's why we're pretty consistent about sticking to sort of the first 10 year window for analyzing policies like this. It's also useful to sort of keep the long term in mind, right? We're not getting to zero by 2030. This is a long term problem. So we don't by any means mean to imply that we shouldn't have a long-term perspective on this. But I do think it's important, at least when we're taking a quantitative look at what the impacts might be, to focus in on sort of where we can reliably project them.
Great. Well, it is 5 o'clock, and I. But before we go, just a couple things. Want to plug. So we will be looking at economic impacts and this analysis a little bit more closely this Thursday night at the next Citizens Climate Lobby University. Noah won't be there. Again, I am personally very grateful that in the battle ahead, if you will, in the long path that we are engaging in, we have people like Noah and the peer-reviewed community. They love what we're doing, and they're here for us. And I really want to show some appreciation for that. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for coming.